As you know, sessions here will be recorded, and cassette tapes will be available out in the lobby for those that you are not able to attend, or sessions you find so good that you want to share with your friends back home. Because of that, we're going to be asked that people have their comments always repeated, their questions repeated into the microphone throughout the sessions. And if you have comments that you might want to make throughout the rest of the week, feel free to come up to the podium in whatever room it is and speak into it, because that certainly is one of the major complaints of people who try to partake of the symposium from afar. They don't get to hear the audience comments. Now this year we're doing something new. Many of you probably are aware of it. We're also having selected sessions broadcasted on KCPW, a new public radio station here in Salt Lake City, which is a sister station to KPCW, the PC standing for Park City. So they're housed in Park City. The station, for the most part, the sessions which will be broadcast are noted in the final program with the KCPW logo. Most of them will originate from this room. And for that purpose, for that reason, we have set up these chairs along the wall where Paul Swenson has deigned to sit. And those comments will need to be recorded so that they can be broadcasted. So if you plan to make a comment when you're in a session in this room, you'll need to line up along those chairs and then speak into that microphone, as we will do tonight. So I assume Paul is getting ready to make some comments. So that's something to be aware of throughout the symposium. This symposium has been the work of a lot of people, Sunstone staff and countless volunteers who have labored diligently to bring it to pass. It's when you hold the document in your hand, the program, it is almost the equivalent of producing another magazine when you consider all the little tidbits of information that are in there. And it is not an easy task to get these pundits to do simple things like sending in their biographical information or their paper or an abstract of their session to get into the program. So every little tidbit of information that we casually breeze by here has been brought to you by blood, sweat, and tears, and has been orchestrated by our symposium chair, Greg Campbell. I'd like to introduce to you now, even though he's not dressed appropriately, but that's because he's been working very hard all day long. Greg standing in the back in the blue shirt and the skinny hat. So take time throughout this symposium to express your appreciation or your comments or criticisms to Greg. And I'll be wearing sunglasses, so you won't be able to recognize me. I think those are the general announcements that I want to make at the present. We'll be making a few more at the end. So let's begin this session then with an invocation by Greg Hinckley, who's a student at BYU in anthropology, and then we'll go from there. In fact, while Greg's coming up, let me introduce what's going to happen right after the prayer. The Mormon humorist par excellence, extraordinaire, Laurie Johnson, those of you might remember her from when she spoke at one of our afternoon plenary, lunchtime humor sessions a couple of years ago, is going to read a humorous poem to get us started off. As you're familiar, Sunstone champions Mormon humor in various formats. And so we thought instead of a musical number or a poetry reading, tonight we would start with a humorous poem that Laurie's going to share with us as she performs. For those of you who become enchanted with her, she's also going to be doing another number later on Saturday in a humor session. So Greg will open the session, and then Laurie will move into her number.
Dear God, we're so thankful for the opportunity we have of meeting here at this beautiful summer evening. We're thankful for this time of gathering and enlightenment and learning which we have. We ask you to please bless that a spirit of learning and understanding as well as a good feeling will be here this evening and throughout the meetings, that we will all be able to open our minds and learn and take with us new information. We also ask you to please help us be better people, to help those around us and better our lives as well as our neighbors and our friends and those that are less fortunate than we are. And we say this humbly in the name of thy Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Well, I hate to have to stand in front of a group like this after that and embarrass myself. That was a very nice introduction. I appreciate it. I know you do two funny things and get the reputation as a Mormon humorist. I once dropped a quiche upside down and had to hide the damage by decorating it with chopped olives, and I became known in that circle as a gourmet cook. Marty Esplin asked me to do this, read a poem, and this is not really what I do, and I have to leave this evening and catch a plane. I'm sorry I don't have time to do it. It's not good. It's not really what I do, but I would like to encourage you anyway to come and hear Mormon humorous poetry on session 361. On second thought, apparently Sister Esplin has a strong desire for me to read this, and because of my concern for all of our safety, I'll just go ahead and read this message that she's just handed to me. Oh, how lovely was the morning that first Sunday in July. As they left Relief Society, several sisters dabbed an eye, vowing to increase their efforts to redeem those who are lost, do temple work and pay their tithes, and twice a year defrost. Priesthood meeting had been peaceful with no rancor or debate. Lesson 12, male pattern baldness, is it preordained or fate? And the brethren were inspired toward improvement by the preaching, as some wondered if those foyer chats could count toward home teaching. And then we pushed through to the chapel with much loud and hearty greeting, exchanging jokes and gossip before testimony meeting. And those who had been absent due to sickness, golf, or trout got the common admonition, "Well, it's good to see you out." The organ music on that morn, it even seemed more sweet. Sister Pratt hit some familiar chords and almost kept the beat. With tolerance and brotherhood and love, our bosoms filled. Nary a child was crying, nor Cheerio was spilled. The spirit of that special day, was it too good to last? Lo, hardly a soul was heard to say, "Oh, flip, forgot to fast." The bishop gave the signal, softly closed the chapel doors. "My brethren and my sisters, now the meeting time is yours." And instantly a brother stood and sprinted for the stand. In quick relays, the microphone was passed from hand to hand. The urge to speak had touched upon each member and his crony, each one more anxious than the last to bear their testimony. A stranger there would surely think the spirit must be strong to spark such fervent testifying in this humble throng. But it wasn't divine influence that inspired the crowd to speak, but more a game of keep away from Brother Vanderbeek. See, if you'd lived long in the ward, you didn't need a warning. Give Vanderbeek just half a chance, he'd talk for half the morning. He was a goodly Christian man, you couldn't help but like. You'd give him anything you owned, except a traveling mic. We all had heard the stories of his pioneer forebears, and though it once was touching, after 20 years, it wears. No one seemed to care much if the words were true or phony. Just keep it moving. That's the key to fast and testimony. From right to left, with microphone in hand, the deacon streaked, tactfully avoiding dear old brother Vanderbeek. In only 7 minutes, we would close with prayer and song. Never in ward history had he been still so long. The counselor nudged the bishop. You believe this lucky break? Perhaps the old guy's sleeping. If we're quiet, he won't wake. The bishop smiled, well satisfied, and said, things are improving. Just then, the counselor gripped his arm and gasped, oh no, he's moving. And sure enough, the gnarled old hands were straining on the pew. Before our stricken eyes, bent shoulders shuddered into view. His flesh was clearly willing, though our spirits all were weak. 'Twas 5 to 12, and we were doomed to hear old Vanderbeek. Brothers and sisters, he began, not waiting for the mic. The bishop had a stricken look. Two deacons took a hike.
The Lord has richly blessed me. I'm a fortunate old man, and I'd be most ungrateful if I failed today to stand.
Counting each one in his family, telling how he loved them so, reporting everything they'd done since just a month ago. There'd been weddings, moves, and birthings, and a slew of baseball games.
I've 8 sons and 50 grandkids.
And he told us all their names.
Most of them are righteous and do as they've been told. Except one feminist intellectual. And Bruce, who's left the fold.
After that, he started stories from the first of his 3 missions. Tales of healing and conversions and the time he had a vision. The local food and customs learned in missionary days.
The Lord respects all people and their childish backward ways.
All eyes kept shifting toward the clock, the hands that dragged so slow. It was 12 noon already with 2 missions left to go. And with our nerves, his lengthy, detailed stories still unraveled. Then brightening, he said,
now, let me tell you world.
He carefully described each mile, attractions, stops, and views. The floors were slick and crunchy from the toddlers neath the pews. I was sure my watch was broken, but then no, I heard it tick.
Did I mention, Brother V began, the time I got so sick?
And so he launched into the string of tales about disease, his surgeries, incontinence, the trouble with his knees. The teenage girls looked spooky with the way their eyes were spinning. Up front, the deacons hunkered down, all whispering and grinning.
I feel I must admonish and give counsel to the youth,
intoned old Brother Vanderbeek.
I'm here to speak the truth.
His bony pointing finger waggled, jabbing in the air.
These girls are disrespectful, and you boys have sissy hair.
By now, we'd lost all hope of naps and food and earthly pleasures. The chorister sought frantically a song with just 4 measures. And every child was whining. Several diapers sprung a leak, but none dared move and draw the wrath of Brother Vanderbeek. But then, the voice was slowing, something changing in the sound. And yes, we all could hear it. He was surely winding down. Thank the Lord. The words he spoke were leading to a close. Our hearts rejoiced. Some wept aloud. The bishop blew his nose.
I know I've taken up your time and spoken far too much. But I have a testimony I will tell you now in Dutch. Mijn heer van Dederbisten.
He began the spiel anew. Oh, cruel fate, a dirty trick. How could this curse be true? We'd sat there and we'd listened. The wanting just to scram. No one knew a word of Dutch and no one gave a damn. We didn't care if he was old or senile, kind or meek. 100 desperate plans were hatched to silence Vanderbeek. And yes, you might have known the lot of us always were sinners. Forget the love and brotherhood. These people missed their dinners. The gibberish droned. Our stomachs groaned. We felt ourselves grow older. The counselor drooled peacefully upon the bishop's shoulder. Then once again, the room was still and filled with silent peace. Believe, you unbelievers, Brother Vanderbeek has ceased. The silence was a blessing, a great gift from up on high. Repenting of our wicked thoughts, we jointly heaved a sigh. And all that he need do now was to say, Amen, and sit. And still he stood at 12:30, although his voice had quit. He'd covered all the bases, his witness he had borne. Then motionless, he hung his head, all emptied out and worn. And seeing now how tired he seemed, I felt a sense of shame for anger toward this aged man. I cleared all thoughts of blame. For all of us are growing old, and when our time is gone, an extra minute or 25, it doesn't seem so long. The dear old man was finished, yet he didn't take the bench.
I have a testimony! I will tell you now in French.
Thank you very much. And if you want to do a third humorous performance, you can have this pulpit next year, too. Well, being editor of Sunstone Magazine gives me one of my favorite perks from that job is that I get to sort of be a generalist and go around and visit and talk with all our different academics and contributors to the discussions that occur in our community. And sometimes when I'm sitting in a professor's office and we're just talking and I'm catching up on what is in the air these days, I think, am I really getting paid for doing this? You know, it's like I'm back in school. But one of the interesting things that struck me the other day as I was talking to a friend was I go visit with, you know, a person who's in the sciences, and sometimes they have, they'll say, you know, the brethren are wrong on this instance, or I don't see our doctrine the same way. And they're coming at it from their scientific background. And they accept a large amount of Mormonism, but when it comes within their discipline, they view things very differently. And you go to someone else in the social sciences, and they, because of their academic discipline, view an awful lot very differently from the orthodox opinion, or many of them do. And the same is true if you go to people in the humanities and the arts and various disciplines. One of the challenges for me is not to get discouraged, because I'm somewhat of an assimilationist, and I can take all of these things, and then it's really hard to make sense of things. But I was at the American Academy of Religion last fall, and they have a session each year called How My Thinking Has Changed, where people from their profession who do religious studies get up and talk about how they once put a puzzle together this way and they now put it this way. And I've thought that would be a good tradition to start here in Sunstone. So for this first edition of this session, I thought we would look at how my thinking has changed, how my academic discipline affects my religious views. I think in future sessions, which I'd like to do this annually, not always in a general session, we could look at just the reverse, how my religious thinking or my religious views affect my experience in the academic discipline. And another one would be how my thinking has changed, you know, the great books and authors who have changed the way I see my religious life. So those of you who have suggestions in this course, I'd be interested in considering them for the future. Nevertheless, this has been perhaps the hardest panel, well, the second hardest panel I've ever had to organize at the Sunstone Symposium. The hardest was, now I feel like I'm Brother Vanderbeek. The hardest was the very first symposium I organized with Alice and Bethke Gayak, who's here in the audience, I think, or talking in the hall. We had planned a Pillars of My Faith luncheon session, and we invited one of the speakers to be the first Mormon Pulitzer Prize winner, and another person was to be a renowned Mormon poet, and the third was to be an advisor to the president. And in the week happening before that symposium, both the Pulitzer Prize winner and the poet canceled because they were dying of cancer. And President Reagan called the advisor off to some meeting, and he wasn't able to speak either. And we had to invite some other people to speak who gave some very good addresses. Some of them were eventually published in the magazine. But we sort of had to punt that year in scrambling at the end. That has been the case this year. Michelle Stott has been the only person who's been on this panel from the start. We've had people sign up and cancel off and on throughout the summer. Some of you may have noticed in our preliminary program that Michelle's name appeared alone and there were some to be announced. Some of those were people who didn't quite want their name in the program yet, but were solidly on. But they're no longer solidly on. So let me introduce our speakers, and I hope you understand with charity some of their comments or the context of some of their comments. Michelle has a PhD in German literature from the University of Utah, and she's working on a forthcoming book on Kierkegaard, and her emphasis is 18th and 19th century German women authors. And I think given that context, she'll have some very interesting comments. Her comments are probably the most thought out because she's had the longest time. For the next two people, they were signed up very late, like since Sunday. But nevertheless, these are topics which are not new to them, and I think they have a lot to say to us. Let's follow with Karen Maloney, who is an assistant professor of English at Weber State University. She received her PhD from UCLA in modern British and Irish literature. She formerly was on the Dialogue Board, and she used to be a Sunstone correspondent when she lived in California, and she is a very good Mormon poet. Finally, we'll follow up with Armin Moss, who is a professor of sociology at Washington State University. Is that right? Good. And Armin has written an article looking at the Mormon culture called The Angel and the Beehive. Do I have that right? Close? That's the book title, which is coming out next year. From who? University of Illinois Press, the Mormon publisher. Armin is a regular contributor to the Sunstone discussions, and his comments appear frequently in the pages of Dialogue and Sunstone. Then I think we'll turn some time over to audience contributions. I think we have lots of people here from various disciplines who, as you're thinking about your own religious views and how your academic discipline has affected you, you might want to share them with the audience briefly. And as I indicated earlier, you would need to line up here, and then we'll have you speak one by one. The other advantage of having you sit down is that if we go late, it's polite to cut off because we don't have to listen to everyone who lines up. So so that's a challenge to think through your comments and to say them as briefly as possible. So we'll turn the time over to these people in that sequence, Michelle and Karen, and then Armand. Thank you.
I'm afraid it's terrible to make a serious paper follow something like that. I'm afraid it won't be quite as entertaining, but I hope I'll be able to at least be interesting. I should say the book on Kierkegaard, or Kierkegaard, is actually coming out. The book I'm working on is on the 18th and 19th century German women. The only reason I say that is that it shows a progression that I'll be talking about tonight and a change in the direction I've been taking in my own work. As you've been told, we're supposed to talk tonight about the effect that our academic disciplines have had on our religious views. And I really can think of few topics that would be of more significance to me, since this brings into focus two of the most powerful forces in my life. This, if you want to call it exposition, will almost of necessity take the form of an intellectual autobiography, which I hope will be useful to someone who's listening. A long time ago, before I had any idea how important academic inquiry would become for me, I read in a history class about a 12th century Islamic philosopher named Averroes, who, like his contemporary Avicenna, attempted to bring all knowledge and thought into harmony with his religious beliefs. The idea that I could reconcile what was going on in my head with what was going on with my faith was so compelling that I immediately sketched out a massive project to demonstrate how the development of Western philosophy had helped to prepare humankind for the restoration of the gospel. This project didn't get very far, as you might well guess, partly because I didn't have a lifetime to devote to it. But nevertheless, it was valuable to me, in the sense that this desire to show that the intellectual and spiritual pursuits I was involved in are really only differing aspects of the same thing. This idea had taken root in my mind and was somewhere back there growing in the dim recesses of my thought. After this particular moment of awareness, I really can't document any memorable interchange between the intellectual and the spiritual spheres until I entered graduate school. Part of the reason for that, I might explain, is that I began as a music major, and I was practicing the piano 10 hours a day, so I didn't have a lot of time to think about philosophy. But in the process, I changed over to German, and that started me going in different directions with literature and some other things. So I entered graduate school, and following my inclination toward philosophy, I enrolled in a course on existentialism and literature, in which we read a number of authors such as Sartre and Camus. Somewhere along the way, we came across Søren Kierkegaard, a Danish Christian philosopher of an existential bent. In fact, he's sometimes called the father of existentialism. We didn't actually spend much time on his writings in the class, but I was so intrigued by the way in which he had welded together his Christian belief and his philosophical conviction that I bought a volume of his edifying discourses and began reading on my own. I really can't describe adequately to you the potency and the power with which these texts penetrated my thinking. This was something that really happened to me. I don't know how to explain how it feels to live and experience a text, but I lived these texts. Even now, after so many years, this Kierkegaardian awakening stands out as one of the most crucial turning points in my entire life. What I found in Kierkegaard was the demand that theory and abstract thought be brought down out of the stratosphere into the actual day-to-day existence and experience of the individual. In terms of Christian theology, this is the insistence that the doctrinal beliefs you talk about and speculate about on Sunday must become strictly identical with what you are, what you think about from moment to moment, your decisions, attitudes, and actions as you live each second of each day. Kierkegaard decried those who gesticulate with their hands while they make eloquent but empty speeches from the podium or lectern. Instead, he called for individuals who gesticulate with their lives, who have gone beyond mere talk about what Christianity is and instead truly are Christians. He condemned professors who do not profess, philosophers who have left themselves as existing individuals out of their philosophy, Christians who are religious in name only, people who gain their attitudes and opinions from the newspaper rather than taking responsibility for choosing and acting based on their individual relationship with God, even if these actions and decisions go against the tendencies of the crowd. Suddenly, while reading these texts, I saw clearly that my own religious belief had always existed out there somewhere, in church meetings and activities, in words, in books, but never really in me. Through what became a very intensive and wide-ranging study of Kierkegaard's authorship, resulting incidentally in a doctoral dissertation that now has become a book, and also an article in Dialogue on Existentialism and Mormonism, so if you're interested, you can go look it up, I began to learn how to be what I believed, so that there was no separation between myself and my own faith in Christ and his gospel. Of course, I don't wish to assert that I never had previously come across similar ideas in church meetings, conference talks, and so forth. But somehow, those sources didn't speak in an idiom that I understood, or with the right intensity, the right vocabulary, so that I could hear and comprehend. It was specifically the encounter with Kierkegaard that transformed my religious experience from essentially passive thought to a vibrant, active force identical with myself. In the course of this process, I also realized something significant about the relationship between what we unfortunately call secular knowledge and religious knowledge. That is, what we find in the scriptures and in the gospel are sets of values, descriptions of attitudes, and examples of ways of relating to others, ourselves, and God. But individuals must find their own ways to build those attitudes into themselves, to actualize those values and prototypical modes of behavior in their own lives. For many of us, this sort of how-to manual will come from our engagement, often our grappling, with what the scriptures call the best books, the histories, the literature, the theories and theorems, the collected results of centuries of the human search for truth, understanding, and enlightenment. Certainly this has been the case for me. Religion only works, at least in my opinion, if it speaks in a voice and vocabulary that people understand, but that voice will be different for each individual. Mutual interchange between my academic and religious experience hasn't arisen from books alone. I also have had the advantage of friends, associates, fellow students, and later colleagues who were either not LDS or who had withdrawn themselves from active involvement with the LDS Church. Over the years, these people have come to me again and again asking, "What do you believe about this?" or "How can you believe that?" In finding answers for them, I've been forced to sort through my internal library of beliefs, to test concepts, values, and attitudes, to define for myself just what I really do believe and why. This process, though often painful and confusing, and sometimes heated by debate, has helped me to reshape my religious convictions and sort them out from an inherited, indiscriminate mixture of spiritual, cultural, and social beliefs into something which I have appropriated, defined, and chosen, something which I own, something which is me. The hardest part of this process has sometimes been sorting out what is actual doctrine and what is cultural baggage, but I think my beliefs have become much more simple and streamlined as I've begun to win my way free of the sort of societal flotsam and jetsam that one accumulates over the years. I didn't discover women until I had finished my graduate degrees. Now it gets interesting. Until I had finished my graduate degrees and moved on into a career. In academic terms, I was bred and educated completely within the traditional male paradigm, a token man in a field that had been, and still is actually. Nevertheless, whatever has happened, women have been there also. This interest in women's existence and achievement quite naturally led me into an intensive engagement with feminist thought and theory. It's impossible for me to separate my academic encounter at this point with feminist thought from my religious encounter, so I'll be talking about both of them together. For me, they're the same thing. I'm an existentialist. You have to remember that. Anyway, the questions asked in the books I was reading, the approaches taken to traditional assumptions and bodies of knowledge were entirely new to me. I was reared as a man. And I quickly found out that much of what I always believed or assumed to be true about people, society, relationships, history, and a whole host of other areas was under aggressive and energetic attack. Like my friends before, the feminist writings asked again and again, "How can you believe this? What do you think about that?" But this time the questioning went much deeper into beliefs and assumptions I had never even thought about as problematic before. I can understand from going through this myself how many people, when they encounter feminist ideas or views of the world, react with such violent anger, denial, and rejection. Because it seemed to me at first that the whole world was being turned inside out, upside down. And I suffered from a strong sense of vertigo that was only settled in time through intense study and thought, a lot of discussion with many different people, and the sheer will to hold things together until I could really understand and decide for myself how much validity and truth the views I was encountering contained. In time, though, I discovered something which helped to restore my balance. That is, the areas within the religious sphere which I felt most to be under attack were not actually questions of doctrine. Now, I'm talking about my own experience. You may talk to other people who feel differently, but this is what I encountered. The conflicts I was feeling were almost all in the area of LDS culture and tradition, habits of thoughts and attitude so ingrained that they seemed to be gospel truth, but in fact were not the gospel. That's when I realized that, although in the religious sense, LDS doctrinal belief is often quite different from that held by other Christian denominations, our social attitudes and assumptions are most often the same as those current in American culture in general. Here I'm speaking specifically of attitudes toward gender roles, masculinity and femininity, the place of woman and of man, education and activities for boys versus those for girls, and so forth. As I dug deeper into the scriptures in an attempt to establish just how much of my belief was doctrinal and how much cultural, I determined that most of the areas in which I had felt myself under attack as a Mormon were connected with cultural assumptions that are not unique to the LDS religion, but which have been adopted wholesale from sources outside the church sphere. In all this searching and sorting, I was hampered by the fact that I had no clear sense or definition of what feminist thought was, or at least what it was for me. Most people talk about feminism as if it were some sort of monolithic structure that you can take in your hand and say, "Here it is, this is what it's all about." That, of course, is a misconception. There are numerous feminisms ranging across the spectrum from liberal to conservative, with radicals and ultras on both ends. And at that particular time, although I knew what a lot of other people thought, I couldn't say whether or not I personally was a feminist or what ideas I specifically advocated. That is, until I engaged a book on feminist theory by bell hooks, an African-American author and theorist, a book which caught me with the same power and force as Kierkegaard's works had earlier. I've had a little trouble with telling people about this because when I say, "I own this book," then they say, "Yes, but you're a white person owning something written by a black person and you can't do that." So I'm talking about the force with which her ideas struck me, and I'm not trying to appropriate her experience and make it into something that it wasn't. But it struck me with that same kind of power. Through Kierkegaard, I found a way to make abstract gospel principles an active part of myself. Through bell hooks, I found a definition for what I believed and a way to actualize abstract feminist thought in my life. Perhaps even more importantly, I found that my religious beliefs and my feminist convictions, rather than being at odds, actually strengthened and clarified one another. Hooks defines feminist movement as the struggle to transform society by consciously working to eradicate all forms of domination, oppression, discrimination, aggression, violence, and exploitation wherever they may occur. This includes, but isn't limited to, sexism and racism. In formulating this definition, Hooks has codified some of the general goals which underlie most forms of feminist thought. But these ideas are also in strict accordance with gospel principles, as they were taught by Jesus Christ, even though they will almost inevitably bring one into conflict with many cultural attitudes and habits. There isn't time this evening, at least I assume you don't want to stay all night, to elaborate on all the intersections between my understanding of feminist thought and my religious belief, but I'll try to sketch out some of the most important correspondences. It seems to me, from my ransacking of the scriptures, that the most basic and essential core of the gospel is crystallized in Christ's response to the question of which commandment should be considered the greatest. His answer was that we must first love God with full intensity and intent, and secondly, that we should love our neighbors as we love ourselves. The primary status of these commandments is underscored by his insistence that, quote, on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets, unquote. A great deal of effort has been spent in defining just who the neighbor is and isn't, often so that we don't have to pay attention to people that we don't want to. We just say they're not our neighbors, so we don't have to care about them. And a lot of effort has gone into deciding just what these three directions of love towards God, oneself, and others really entail. But it's clear to me from numerous scriptural passages that Christ meant all our interactions with all others, irrespective of gender, race, color, or system of belief. As I have studied the scriptures from my feminist perspective, I've realized that from the very beginning of scriptural history, two basic paradigms for relating to and governing human beings are presented. One pattern, illustrated through Satan and his dealings with human beings, is characterized by the will to and thirst for power, force and coercion exercised on those who refuse to cooperate, and violence and aggression enacted mercilessly on those who don't have the might to defend themselves. The pattern presented by Christ is the direct opposite, since it's anchored squarely in the agency given to each individual to choose good or ill and accept the consequences of those decisions. This system is based on love, acceptance, forgiveness, forbearance, mercy, and a host of other non-power-seeking, non-self-aggrandizing, and therefore non-popular characteristics. It's amply clear that the first paradigm, rooted in force and violence, has governed the majority of human relationships since the moment when Cain murdered Abel. It has also become evident to me that, in this sense, the gospel of Jesus Christ directly contradicts the entire basis of Western society and civilization, insofar as social, political, and economic structures rest upon oppression, exploitation, and domination. And here we need only to think of examples such as the Machiavellian view that the public realm is amoral, and therefore beyond the reach of moral or ethical considerations, or the tenets of social Darwinism, with its emphasis on the survival of the fittest, vicious competition, and aggressive preemptive action, concepts which have had massive force in shaping the attitudes of American society today. Based on the prevalence of this paradigm in our cultural and societal mindset, it's perhaps inevitable that this type of misrelationship should in some ways have infiltrated even our attempts to form a religious community based on the gospel paradigm of Jesus Christ. And in this, my particular concern is the way force and domination come out, particularly in the home, in relationships between husbands and wives. I think most of you could talk about people you know who have a lot of trouble in this area. One of the most exciting insights I've come upon in my feminist scriptural ponderings was pointed out by a friend who noted that part of the immense value of the Book of Mormon, part of the value it has for us, is that it strikingly illustrates the repeated failure of what we could perhaps call the mortal or worldly paradigm of force, violence, and aggression. The more I thought about it, the more I realized that the illustrations of this fact are almost too numerous to list. For example, the original quarrel between brothers, which led to great physical and mental suffering hearing on Nephi's part, including beatings and attempted murder, was a question of the traditionally preeminent power and authority of the eldest son and heir in the face of a usurping younger brother. The response of the people both in Jerusalem and on the American continent to a prophet who spoke unpopular doctrine was to attempt to kill him, naturally. Whether this be Lehi, Abinadi, or Samuel the Lamanite. In fact, the response to anyone who disagreed with someone's views seemed to have been murder. Laman and Lemuel's attempts to kill Nephi, Nehor's murder of the aged Gideon, the Lamanite king's command that his son kill Ammon, and so forth. Add to that Noah's attempts to kill Alma and his followers, and the wholesale burning of believers, including women and children, by the people of Ammoniah, an action which was attempted once again just prior to the birth of Christ. Almost the entire history of both Nephite and Lamanite government is riddled by corruption and violence brought on by those who demanded power and dominion over those around them. The history of the Jaredites is one long round of usurpation of authority, enslavement of others, conquest, and civil war. The end of both the Nephites and the Jaredites is characterized by such hatred and thirst for blood and vengeance that the people joyfully execute inhuman atrocities on each other. The entire account of the Book of Mormon, and I know this because my sister bought a videotape of the Book of Mormon stories for her children and can't show it because it's too violent and it upsets the children to watch it. This is true. She told me this. The entire account of the Book of Mormon from beginning to end is strewn with fire and sword, dead bodies by the thousands, rivers dyed with blood, murder, assassination, and arrogance. Set against this satanic paradigm of force is Christ's paradigm of love and forgiveness, meekness and faith, freedom of choice and will, a pattern which repeatedly brings peace, prosperity, and happiness to those who incorporate it as their way of life, however fleeting the space of time in which these principles are actually lived. These things are in there, but you have to look for them. They take up much less space. Although perhaps not as striking, other volumes of Scripture attempt as well to break down paradigms of force and violence, replacing them instead with the Christ-centered pattern of choice and responsibility, repentance, forgiveness, and Christ-like love. In the New Testament, Christ himself repeatedly and deliberately attacks destructive and stagnant traditions. Particularly striking is his non-traditional acceptance of women and of other groups generally rejected and devalued by Jewish society, such as Romans and other Gentiles, Samaritans, the poor, and those labeled as sinners. These radical attempts to revise and controvert the ruling mortal paradigm of force also continue in the Doctrine and Covenants. In fact, the DNC is immensely critical for us in that, among other things, it is the handbook by which church organization and structure were established, and the rights and limitations of priesthood authority were defined specifically for our period of time. One red flag which has often arisen with particularly violent repercussions in the LDS encounter with feminist thought is the frequent feminist attack on patriarchy. But this is one of those junctures at which much apparent conflict can be eliminated by a careful definition of exactly what all parties mean by the word patriarchy. In traditional terms, patriarchy represents the elevation of the man to the position of lord and master, to whom all others are considered vassals and servants and possessions. In particular, the woman is of no value in this order except as she is pleasing to the man, fills his needs, and bears his children. The laws of couverture, for example, were so strenuous in England and carried over into other countries that the moment a woman married, she ceased to exist as a human being. She had no rights. There were no laws that covered her. She was a non-entity. She belonged to her husband. As the scriptures show, however, Christ's models, both for leadership and for interpersonal relationships, stand in direct contradiction to this type of patriarchal domination. And in fact, his words condemn that type of misrelationship quite thoroughly. So you need to know what you're talking about instead of just reacting to terminology. Christ insists, for example, that the greatest of all should be the servant of all. Against the idea of hierarchical power and authority, he asserts the concept of stewardship and consecration, a system in which no individual can or should be valued above any other, and all things are accomplished in terms of responsibility and accountability to the Lord. In DNC 121, Christ established a very strict description of how priesthood leadership should function and what its limitations are. There he warns that this authority cannot function properly in the hands of those whose, quote, hearts are set upon the things of the world and who aspire to the honors of men, and that the powers of heaven, as connected to priesthood power, respond only to righteousness. He then insists emphatically that, quote, when we undertake to cover over our sins, or to gratify our pride, our vain ambition, or to exercise control or dominion or compulsion upon the souls of the children of men and women in any degree of unrighteousness, unquote, that the Spirit of the Lord and priesthood authority are withdrawn from that man. I say man here because men are the ones who hold the priesthood. But this also would apply to women who are acting unjustly toward other people, and that certainly does happen. Christ then warns in an often quoted and often disregarded statement that, quote, we have learned by sad experience that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, and we can add women, as soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion, unquote. In other words, as soon as most people gain a sense of power and authority, they fall into the trap of acting according to Satan's paradigm, which has been the ruling pattern for the world for so long that we often view it as natural or normal. And here I think of scriptures about the natural human being as an enemy to God. I think this applies to that. In opposition to this privileging of domination and aggression, however, the Lord sets a list of the qualities required for the proper use of authority and priesthood power, ones generally viewed as non-masculine or feminine by the world at large. Persuasion, long-suffering, gentleness, meekness, love unfeigned, kindness, charity, virtue, and an absence of hypocrisy and guile. I could go on the topic of feminism, the gospel, and scriptures, but I have to let other people speak. So I'll conclude with the hope that maybe these few examples have shown to some degree how my academic feminist thought is absolutely integral to my religious belief, since feminism for me is a request for a truly unbiased, undifferentiated, equal application of gospel principles to all people, regardless of gender, race, color, financial position, marital status, or any of the other categories which we use to label people and erect walls between them. I see feminism as a tool that can be used to break down webs and walls of ignorance, blindness, bias, and unquestioned assumption so that we can see more clearly how things really are. Therefore, it can be a way of coming closer to God through learning better ways of relating to and serving His children. In my encounter with feminism, as with all other ideas I've come across in my academic endeavors, I've found an unerring guide in the Book of Mormon Scriptures, quote, and whatsoever thing persuadeth men and women to do good is of me, for good cometh of none save it be of me, and unquote. And again, quote, and whatsoever thing is good is just and true. Wherefore nothing that is good denieth the Christ, but acknowledgeth that he is, unquote. For me, my encounter with feminist thought, as my encounter with Kierkegaardian thought, have been a good and have led me closer to Christ. Therefore, I feel this has been something which has strengthened my belief. Through all this long process of intellectual and spiritual growth and ripening, perhaps the most important thing I've learned is that I have nothing to fear from any idea or viewpoint which I might come across. It may require patience and even courage, but I've watched again and again as seemingly sinister monsters have melted away as I dismantled the threat by coming to understand what actually was being said. I have found that most of the time, when my intellectual pursuits seem to come into conflict with my religious beliefs, it isn't because there's no room within the gospel sphere of truth for the things I'm learning, but rather because my own perceptions of both the gospel and the academic topic are limited, narrow, undefined, unpondered, and therefore shaky. For this reason, it's precisely my long intellectual struggle with hard and sometimes apparently threatening ideas which has made my religious belief what it is and given my faith a stability and durability I might never have found otherwise. Thank you.
Well, my own essay is a good deal shorter than Michelle's, but I have a perfect excuse. I didn't find out until last night, about 24 hours ago, that my name was on the program. So, at last year's symposium, I participated on a panel in which I was asked to consider the effect of the 60s on my Mormonism. Clearly, I'm involved in a similar project tonight, though the catalyst I'm asked to reflect upon is, in this case, my academic discipline. And because, after all, I am an English teacher, familiar with the pitfalls of assigning a cause-and-effect paper to my students, I will begin with the same caveat that I did last year. It is immensely difficult to isolate the effects of my academic discipline alone on my religious views. For certainly the nature of my religious faith today is the result of many variables and may as well have influenced the approach I take to my academic discipline. But having made that disclaimer, I have made an effort to disentwine the two and to examine the role played in my religious life by my study of literature written in English. I've always loved words, writing, stories, drama, and poems. I grew up in a home where I was taught that our books were our friends. Each day before my brother and I were sent off for our naps, we were allowed to choose three or four books each from our two shelves of golden books, which my mother faithfully read to us before we took off for our naps. Each night, then, before we fell asleep, my father told us stories. When we were a little older, my mother introduced us to the local library. I can still recall the real thrill of discovering row after row of children's biographies, Albert Payson Terhune dog books, and Marguerite Henry horse books. Perhaps not surprisingly, the study of language came easily for me in elementary school. I loved reading aloud in class, doing book reports, and writing paragraphs. I even got a kick out of diagramming sentences. At home, I was busy beginning to write stories. Ending them was not my particular gift. On the luxurious stationery of my mother's paper towels. And then there was poetry. I still have the golden treasury of poetry which inspired me to mimic the poems I found in its pages. Indeed, I still had those early efforts. I rarely threw anything away. Undoubtedly, I wanted to leave a rich repository behind for the inevitable biographers who would want to study the life of someone who had grown up to become such a famous author. Looking back, I suppose it was inevitable that I would one day attend college and major in English. It was less inevitable that I would pursue graduate degrees and one day be a teacher of college English myself. Still, my point here is that I have always been comfortable with the world of words and imagination. I've always felt at home with a book in my hand. How then has my study of the world's literature, so pleasurable and comforting to me, affected my religious faith? I was raised Catholic, converting to Mormonism 2 months before I left for college. Though at that point in my life, it is far too early to speak of having an academic discipline. I was changing my mind every 2 weeks or so about what I thought I might major in. I did learn early on that an interest in literature was a bit more suspect among the members of my new faith than, say, music. Sacrament meetings had little use for poetry, for example, whereas music was an integral part of the worship service. And I don't recall dating one man who had writes poetry on his list of necessary wifely qualifications, though you could count on plays the piano to be there at the top of the list in yellow highlights. I do play the piano, just very badly. Still, literature was my true love, and after flirting with the idea of other majors, I graduated in English. Teaching on the secondary level convinced me that I would rather teach college. It wasn't that bad. So my interest in words became an academic discipline, and I obtained master's and PhD degrees in literature. In the process, of course, I grew more professional, not to mention older. I also learned a great deal. And so now, from my pinnacle of achievement as a relatively unpublished and fledgling assistant professor, I can look back and assess the impact of my studies on my faith. Due to a large degree to the literature and literary criticism I have read, literature which has increased my familiarity with diverse cultures and time periods, and criticism which has uprooted many of the assumptions with which I grew up, my faith is wider today than it was 20 years ago, less specifically Mormon. Ward and stake boundaries feel more restrictive to me today than they did as an early convert, for at some point during my years in graduate school, my sense of community jumped those fences. The community to which I belong, to which I feel I belong, is only partly Mormon. It is also Australian, German, Irish, Tahitian, South African. It is male and female, married and single, Buddhist, Hindi, and Presbyterian. It is post-colonial and feminist. It is homeless, blue-collar, and advanced degreed. And often, it is a community I feel more acutely when I attend a superb theater production than when I attend sacrament meeting. Particularly if the play in some way touches on the genuine brother and sisterhood of the race, on the suffering we both endure and inflict on each other, and on our ability, occasionally, to transcend our human limitations and embrace compassion. In the beauty of words, in art, I can feel intensely spiritual and renewed, perhaps because art cuts across so many boundaries, boundaries that the gospel also transcends, but sometimes in less visible, tangible, immediate ways. As a result of the study of my discipline, I'm also more comfortable with shades of gray. Early in my graduate career, I dated a doctoral student in chemistry. We didn't always see eye to eye. His approach to the gospel and to most other things in life was fairly rigid, at least to my humanities-trained outlook. At one point, when I was struggling to understand the position he had taken, I remember another friend pointed out that my boyfriend was, after all, a scientist, and it was natural for him to see things in terms of absolutes, in shades of stark black and opaque white. Simply put, we had been trained differently. I have remembered my friend's insight and can confirm his wisdom. My academic discipline has trained me to feel comfortable with ambiguity and lack of resolution. More, it has made me uncomfortable with absolutes, with black and white pronouncements of certainty. It has also made me far less willing to say that all truth resides in any one religious system. Oddly enough, though, my academic discipline has also made me more patient. Where my study of women's literature and feminist theory has made me a feminist, and where my research into ancient Irish mythology and the poetry of the Ulster poet Seamus Heaney has led me to recognize the reality of a feminine deity, I'm also more willing to step back, in my mind at least, and watch the changes in our cultural thinking regarding women that will inevitably occur. Though I wouldn't mind being around 100 years or so now to see those changes, nor do I mind working for those changes now. A study of literature teaches me that change does occur, albeit painfully and slowly. Meantime, though, my academic discipline, well, disciplines actually, in this case, because this particular notion can be traced directly to my earlier training in the field of library science, my academic disciplines have taught me to abhor censorship, to believe in the free play of intelligence and ideas, to believe that truth will out, and to reject many of the techniques currently being directed toward Mormon intellectuals. In the academic field of English, torn as it may currently be by the warring claims of divergent critical theories, I still find a joyful affirmation of life to be at the heart of most literature. Combined with a genuine sense that it is all right to disagree with each other, such affirmation is something I wouldn't mind feeling more often in the community of saints. But my academic discipline has also made me less judgmental. Getting to know so many characters in so many books, characters with so many imperfections, and whose lives are often filled with so many sins, can't help but deepen one's compassion, though I admit it may also make one more impatient toward those who do like to judge and compartmentalize. Most significantly, however, my academic discipline has taught me to see God not only in conventional religious settings, but in the beauty of form and aesthetics. Reading a wonderful poem can fill me with a sense of the grandeur of living and the graciousness of God, as well as a profound sense of community with my fellow travelers. The study of my academic discipline has loosened the tightness of some of my earlier religious interpretations, but it has also brought me genuinely closer to God.
My association with the program goes back 2 days. I told Albert my name was TBA, so that's why that's on there. I'd like to start with just a few introductory remarks about the terminology that I'll be using in reflecting upon the way that the studies of social science, especially sociology, have changed me and my thinking over the years. When we speak of these different disciplines that we've heard discussed tonight, we have a tendency, I think, to lump together social sciences and the humanities, and it makes sense because there are a lot of similarities between them. Both seek understanding of human feelings, motivation, and behavior. And though both social sciences and the humanities, I think, present special challenges to religion that are not resolved yet, as well as have been resolved the challenges presented by the physical and biological sciences. I think a paper scheduled later on in the symposium by John Targin is going to speak to that point. So I'll leave him to deal with that. But there is a sense in which social sciences and humanities have a rivalry with religion in dealing with some of the same questions particularly those that relate to the whys and wherefores of rules and relationships between human beings. Social science overlaps with the humanities and also with the sciences. It kind of straddles the two cultures that C.B. Snow once spoke of years ago. Makes use of the methods of the humanities. Social sciences make use of the methods of the humanities to the extent that they seek for illustration, epitomization, metaphor, and intuitive understanding. Social science, however, overlaps with the sciences, on the other hand, insofar as it tries to impose a systematic or coherent, explicit theory on data and uses comparative logic like control groups and experimental groups and uses quantitative methods. Incidentally, I understand science a little differently from the characterization that is sometimes made that it deals in absolutes. I think that is a rap that maybe you can hang on engineers a little bit more or technicians, but as you review the history of science, I think you find that all the great breakthroughs in science were made precisely by people who did not think in absolutes and instead were capable of understanding the relativity involved, not only in the way different people understand the universe, but the relativity involved, or the difference that it makes when you apply different theories to the same set of data. You get quite different explanations for reality when you apply different theories to the same set of data. There's a lot of relativity there, and I think scientists properly trained understand that. So social science covers then many discrete disciplines like sociology and political science and anthropology, and sometimes history is a social science depending on whether it tends to use more the methods of the humanities or the methods of the social sciences. After that brief introduction to the graphical kind, as my colleagues have, if it matters to anybody, I'm a lifelong member of the church, served more than one mission, and in fact I'm happy each year at the Sunstone Symposium to renew my long-term friendship and love affair with R. Dean Watts, a dear missionary companion, recently sprouted a C. Everett Koop beard. Or maybe it was New England Gothic. We tramped the highways and byways together for several months without purse or scrip, as it was called in those days. And I look back upon those days with great longing, not only because of the friendships and closeness I had with missionary companions, but also because everything was so simple and clear then. But I've always been active in the church. My dear wife and I reared a fairly large family and sent several sons on missions. Gave daughters the same opportunity, but they declined. My earliest undergraduate and graduate work was in history and Asian studies. And finally, for my doctorate at Cal Berkeley, I went into sociology. During all this time, I tried many years to compartmentalize, to put all of my religious thinking in one compartment, you know, and my academic thinking in another. And it just didn't work for me. I don't know if it works for anybody. There are people that I know who say they do it or try to do it, but I don't understand how they do it. There is there's a certain loss of integrity there. I think if the word integrity is connected to integrate, I don't know how you can have integrity without the integration of the two ways of thinking in the head of one person. I simply find it impossible to think one way on Sunday and a different way the rest of the week. I don't want to leave the impression that I've always found resolution in this process of trying to integrate the two. But for me, life has been a process of thinking, rethinking, and seeking resolution and reconciliation between what really are two different worldviews. And we can sometimes identify religious thinking And many will try to explain it away as just a worldview, as opposed to other worldviews. But science is also a worldview, and social science is a worldview with no more a priori or ontological legitimacy than any other worldview. So it's the process of trying to reconcile the two that has really constituted most of my adult life. And obviously, in line with the theme of the program tonight, it has changed my thinking from essentially an unquestioning return missionary to a, well, I don't know what I am, depends on my company. In this gathering, I sometimes think seem kind of stodgy and conservative, and in my high priest quorum, I'm a threat. And I'm the group leader, but I'm still a threat, and I don't know really how we're able to get through this this confrontation together sometimes that I have with my brethren. But as I've applied my understanding of my discipline to my understanding of the church and the gospel, there are a few things that I'd like to just review with you. There, of course, are many examples that I would be inclined to bring out and discuss, but I'll just do a few and try to be cognizant of the time. Mostly, of course, when I talk about the way I look upon the church or gospel, I'm really talking mostly about the church, because that's where we live, isn't it? And Gene England made that so clear in his wonderful essay on why the church is as true as the gospel. I don't know if any of you are aware that the original title for that talk when he gave it at Sunstone was Why the Church is More True than the Gospel. And I liked it better, because I think there's a sense in which that really is true. So most of what all of us deal with as Latter-day Saints is the church. It's the people, isn't it? It's the leaders. It's trying to get along with each other and get things done, and trying to love each other when we're sometimes not very lovable, and all of those things that Gene talked about so well. So much of what I have to say, most of what I have to say, really has to do with the way I look on the church rather than on the gospel per se, which I find increasingly difficult to get contentious about. I think that most of the fundamental things, or the things that most Latter-day Saints think are so fundamental about the gospel, are going to turn out when we get over there on that other side to be so totally different from the way we were taught in Sunday school and everywhere else that there's just no point in arguing about it right now, you know? So I find myself impatient most of the time with arguments about gospel doctrine. It's really church things that concern me. And I think that in the long run, that's probably more important. One thing that my discipline has taught me is the importance of using comparative reasoning whenever I look at the church and look at other things. That has taught me, for example, as I've looked at many other religions around the world and studied some of them quite a bit, that the spiritual commitments and experiences of people in all religions have their own legitimacy. One of the most wonderful, perhaps my favorite passage in the whole Book of Mormon, which is often overlooked, is Alma 28 and 6, where Alma points out that the Lord gives to all people such of his teachings and truth that he thinks they can comprehend and understand. By the way, that's just as true of Mormons, even though we'd like to think that we're different. We have got about all we can understand and then some. So we have no grounds for feeling more smug than people in other religions. But I've thought about that passage in Alma many times as I've looked at other religions and at the deep spiritual experiences and commitments that people of those other religions report. These experiences occur in all cultures, in all religions. and they're all entitled to equal respect. I don't mean necessarily, that doesn't mean necessarily that we accept everything everybody says as somehow, in some ontological sense, true. I've learned not to pass judgment on anybody's spiritual experiences except my own. I simply will consider the reports that I get of other people's spiritual experiences as data. And I will use those reports as data just as I would use answers to questions on a questionnaire as data. And when you look upon the reports in that way, you have to give them the same respect whether they're reported by people in a so-called primitive society or whether they're reported in testimony meeting in our own religion. So that's that comparative view, I think, has helped me to understand the fundamentally human quest and often successful quest for spiritual contact and spiritual experiences. So I don't sneer at anybody's reports of spiritual experiences of their faith or their reports of their own commitments and faith. And I don't sneer at things that I hear in testimony meeting. I know people who do, who think they're just too sophisticated to take seriously any of this stuff that you hear in testimony meeting, all these superstitious reports of people about things that have happened to them. No, Mormons and their reports are entitled to just as much respect as we give Papuans who report about theirs. So that comparative approach has helped me in that way. Another way that the comparative approach has helped me is that I've learned in all religions that there are many levels of religious understanding. But two of the most important levels are what might be called the settled official religious tradition on the one hand and folk religion on the other hand. Every religion has it. And you know, one or both of my colleagues tonight made the observation that, in somewhat different words, that we have just a wonderful, rich folk religion in the Mormon heritage. A lot of times we don't distinguish between folk religion and official religion. Sometimes it's hard to distinguish between the two. And most of the time what we hear over the pulpit or even a general conference doesn't make much of an effort to distinguish between official and folk religion. But I've learned to accept that with equanimity because I feel that I have to grant to my fellow Latter-day Saints the same rights to dabble in their quote-unquote superstitions or folk religion as I would grant to other peoples whose religion I might study in the name of social science. So I don't sneer at their folk religion. It also means, though, that I don't have to take as the teachings of the church, you know, every ridiculous comment that I hear offered in the name of Mormonism, no matter where I hear it. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. I think a lot of us would save ourselves a lot of irritation if we would just remember that just because somebody said it over the pulpit doesn't mean that you have to believe it. And it doesn't mean that it has any standing in the Lord's eyes or anybody else's eyes in particular. But everybody's entitled to his and her own folk religion. I've used comparative reasoning, too, in helpful ways to assess claims about Mormonism, both pro and con claims about Mormonism. For example, we often hear claims that Mormon women have special levels of depression, or that Mormons are especially have especially serious levels or instances of child abuse. Well, I don't see the comparative basis for those generalizations, and until I see the comparative basis, I'm reluctant to accept it. In other words, if I hear that Mormons are high or low in something, I want to know compared to what, compared to whom. And frequently we are given kind of general allegations of that kind without really a comparative basis for judging them. Or on the other hand, we hear that because of the word of wisdom, Mormons have exceptionally low mortality and morbidity rates. Well, compared to whom? Well, I guess compared to Unitarians, maybe. But not compared to Seventh-day Adventists. So, you know, what's high and what's low? And maybe not compared to what we would have as favorable mortality and morbidity rates if everybody really lived the Word of Wisdom, including the strong vegetarian theme in the Word of Wisdom, which is often overlooked. Or we hear sometimes that if you can only get your kids to go to seminary, that they got it made for life. Words to that effect. Well, again, it's really important to look at the comparative basis for statements about or promises about seminary attendance. And in general, what we find is that there isn't a big difference between kids who go all the way through seminary and kids who don't, if you're talking about kids who come from equally devout LDS homes. There is a little advantage. Marie Cornwall, among others, has found that there is an advantage that seminary gives in channeling kids together in the same peer groups. But as far as the instruction that they get is concerned, if you're talking about kids from equally devout homes, and you make the comparison, it's really hard to see a case for seminary. Now, I don't know if this means that everybody's going to go home and pull their kids out of seminary. I don't mean to leave that injunction. But what happens, you see, is that kids from devout homes are, in fact, more likely to go on missions and get married in the temple. And they're also more likely to go to seminary. So that's the usual progression of developments there. Well, aside from this comparative way of reasoning, which I've found so very helpful from my disciplinary training, I've also learned the importance of looking upon reality as a social product. One of the things that we learn is that there are many realities, and they are all socially constructed. That is, they're the product of social processes. Families, subcultures, religions, labor unions, and so on and so forth, all produce realities that serve their interests. So do victims, by the way. That's a fundamental importance, I think, in understanding why we get much of the contention we get about the way things really are. It's difficult to decide sometimes how things really are, and if we're appropriately humble as human beings, to say nothing of humble as social scientists, we will realize that though there may be some ultimate ontological objective reality out there known to God, we will never know it in this life. So operationally, what makes us behave the way we do is not some ultimate objective reality that we understand. It's whatever reality we have agreed on in the fundamental social groups to which we belong. Families define reality for their members. Religions define reality for their members. And wouldn't you know it, all these different definitions of reality have a way of serving the interests of the groups that are defining them. And that's not necessarily bad. That's a human process. That's something that we all should expect to go through. And that happens with bureaucracies too, including church bureaucracies. Individuals take upon themselves their definitions or understandings of reality as a result of being integrated and socialized into these different groups to which they belong. Now, there are many implications of this. This is one reason this group or culture-specific nature of reality is one reason, for example, why LDS testimonies are not so readily replicated by other people. We do hear some wonderful stories about people who are challenged to read the Book of Mormon and ask the Lord if it's true, and they come back and report that this indeed has occurred. A social scientist would point out, well, we need a little comparative reasoning here. How many have gone and asked the Lord if it was true and come back and say that they never got an answer or that it's not true? We have, first of all, have to have that comparative basis, but we also have to know that The whole idea of going to the Lord and asking if something like the Book of Mormon is true is a way of understanding reality that you have to learn by hanging around with Mormons. And when you learn that by hanging around with Mormons, then it makes all kinds of sense to do that. And if people hang around with Mormons long enough, they begin to think like Mormons. Just as hanging around with any group long enough will get you to start thinking like members of that group. Now, one of the implications of this is that whenever we read historical accounts about church history or about family history, we have to try to understand those accounts in the light of the interests being served by whoever is writing those accounts. Because they are expressing giving a certain expression of a socially constructed reality coming out of their family life, coming out of their religious experience, or something else. That doesn't mean that what they're saying isn't true, and it certainly doesn't mean that what they're saying is insincere or deliberately deceptive. It just means that everybody understands reality through the filter of the social memberships that he or she has. And I think that helps us to understand why some converts tell wonderful conversion stories, and they get more wonderful the longer they have been members of the church, because they learn as time goes on to understand what happened to them in fuller ways. And again, it's not that they told it wrong one time or they told it right another time. All of us, well, I don't know about all of us, but most of us have lived long enough here to be able to look back 10 years ago even to an incident that occurred and realize that today we understand that incident differently. And when we look back after 20 years, we'll understand it still differently. And so it's a very interesting thing to study not only what happened, but the changing understanding of how it happened in the minds of individuals as well as in the minds of corporate groups like a church or a family. And many families, when they talk about doing family history, what they want is a family history constructed in a particular way to meet the particular interests of whoever is sponsoring the family history. So sometimes you get a pretty sanitized version of a family history. And we get this a lot in LDS history. For that reason, I've never had any trouble understanding why all of the different accounts of the first vision that we have from Joseph Smith's early experience that are different from each other in certain ways, sometimes in some crucial ways. That never bothered me any. I mean, what would you expect? When it first happens to him, he's just a kid. And reports it later, or at least when somebody writes it down for surviving account several years later, he understands it a little bit differently. A few years later, he understands it differently yet. I don't think that means that there was no first vision. I don't think that means that the first time he told it, he lied, or the last time he told it, he lied and said things that never really happened. That's really a very naive way to look at what happens to people's accounts of reality. So I think we need to understand spiritual experiences, conversion experiences, and all of that from that point of view. And we need to understand that conversion is a process and not an event. And that process might go on a very long time. In the church's official records, they keep track of converts for at least a year after conversion to find out if the conversion took. The church really is working on things like keeping track of retention rates and attrition rates and so on. And a year is the minimum time that you can begin to assume that the person who was baptized and joined the church is really going to stick with it. Even the account of Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus is so fragmentary that it seems clear that he must have had some earlier warming up, so that this didn't all happen quite so suddenly as it seems. By the same token, apostates construct their reality in service of their own interests. I mean, if you were a Mormon for 10 years or 20 years, and finally it dawned on you what a horrible experience you'd had, you got to have an explanation for why you're so damn dumb to get into it in the first place and stick with it so long. And so you get all these apostate accounts that tend to be self-serving in one way or another. But apostates help each other with these accounts. Apostates learn from each other how to reflect back upon what happened to them and to understand those experiences in a different way. It happens the same way, in other words, that it happens with converts. Well, just time is getting away, so I will just add one more thing. My thinking has been much enhanced, I think, by my discipline too, in my operational understanding of church programs and procedures, both past and present. I think I understand what correlation is all about, up to a point, and I see a certain sociological wisdom behind it. But at the same time, I see the need often for local adaptations and modifications, which I freely do without any guilt. I see useful functions, sometimes only symbolic or identity-maintaining functions, for church standards and rules or even folkways that sometimes seem so superstitious. I see enormous sociological sophistication in many church programs. Our proselyting program is, I'm convinced, the most sophisticated proselyting program in the history of humankind. And it's no accident that our present proselyting program began with an extensive research project where literally a bunch of PhD social scientists got together under a committee in the church office building and organized a research project to do a longitudinal study of the conversion process. And much of what we see in the missionary program now is a result of that research, and it makes use of some really fundamental sociological ideas, including the notion I introduced earlier of the social construction of reality. The whole idea behind this friendshipping and fellowshipping is that if you want people to believe like Mormons, you've got to make them hang around with Mormons. And then they will start to believe like Mormons. And we know from the surveys that have been done of converts that the overwhelming majority of them have only the most fragmentary understanding of the gospel or of LDS doctrine when they join the church. Even the adult converts don't know that much more than the 8-year-olds, maybe not as much. But it doesn't matter, because a year later, 2 years later, they'll understand it all. They'll know how to say things. They'll know how to understand and interpret things. That's what socialization is all about. So it's important to get people hanging around with Mormons. We'll worry later about, you know, getting them to believe right. Eventually, you know, we do have to learn to believe right. But that is a process and not something that you get sort of by cramming the way you do for a bar exam. Well, there I could go on about a lot of social science sophistication that I see in many other church programs, and of course some others in which I see a little more research could usefully be done. But in conclusion, I would say that my disciplinary understanding has really greatly enriched my church life. I look upon the church in such a different way. I look upon it as fundamentally a human institution. And when you begin to do that, it makes a lot of difference. I mean, I have no doubt in my own mind that this church has a divine origin. But I also have no doubt that about 95% of the day-to-day operation of the church is totally human. And that doesn't bother me any. You know, as I understand the Mormon God and the Mormon system of revelation, God pretty much turns it over to all of us, including the brethren, but not limited to the presiding brethren and sisters, to run it. You know, it's up to us. And so we stumble and stammer and stagger around and we screw it up, and that's okay. That's why the church is more true than the gospel, because that's where we live. As they say, where the rubber meets the road. And just understanding that the essentially and fundamentally human nature of the church and as an institution, and the fundamentally human and social organizational nature of church life, just has lifted such a burden from me. I can't tell you how liberating that understanding has been. I just don't expect what I used to expect from church leaders. And that's a very important and liberating position to come to. If your expectations are not, you know, pie-in-the-sky expectations, and you think that the church runs by the kind of zap system of revelation where the Lord's always tapping somebody on the shoulder to tell them what to do, when you get rid of all of that nonsense, folk religion, excuse me, when you get rid of all that, then you understand at least the reality that I would urge upon you as our social construction, that the church is essentially a human institution, and what happens in and to the church and its people depends on us, finally. And that has made me a much more tolerant person about church life and saved me enormous irritation over the years as that understanding has grown. Thank you very much.
Well, we have well filled our time, and I'm committed that we will end before 10 o'clock, which is 15 minutes away. But we have time for a few comments, and so if we can be succinct about them concerning the lateness of the hour, I'd appreciate that. Please state your name and who you are.
My name is Dean Chatterjee. I'm a member of the philosophy faculty here at the U for the last 20 years. And I was pleased to hear that our first speaker got started by taking a course in philosophy in our department and got to where she is now today. As a young boy, I used to be a born-again pagan, but doing 30 years of philosophy has made me a militant atheist. It's hard to be a philosophy professor in the state of Utah. When people ask me what brought me over here, I tell them that I'm here on a mission. Now, this is my first time here in this meeting for all these years, even though I've heard about it a lot. And so basically I'm an outsider. And I expected perhaps a bit something more from all three speakers this evening. It was very interesting to listen to all of them. But as a philosopher, I often wonder how one can be an intellectual, especially be in the humanities as a practicing intellectual, and try to integrate one's life so that it's not compartmentalized or schizophrenic. And what I heard right now from all three, how can you afford to be a theist, believe in God, go on talking the way you did? For example, the second speaker said that even though her discipline made her very tolerant in every ways, she is closer to God now than ever before. The third speaker said that he doesn't have any doubt about the divine origin of the Mormon Church. Given that, my question is, perhaps I wanted to hear more about these issues, about the epistemic status of your theistic belief, about how you can have a theistic worldview given the intellectuals that you are. And I didn't hear any of those fundamental issues. You said lots of interesting things, but I don't think you even began to go to the deeper issues where these original doctrinal issues are involved and their epistemic status. So that's my question. I understand it's a big question. I don't know how you can answer it.
Well, we'll see what they say. Anyone want to make a comment?
Well, I don't think that I should be expected to have any more difficulty with a theistic worldview than, say, Descartes had. You always work with a paradigm of some kind about the nature of reality. There may be many reasons why people adopt a theistic as opposed to an atheistic paradigm, but like most paradigms, neither the theistic nor the atheistic is ultimately testable against some ultimate and ontological reality. So I guess fundamentally I would say that in a scientific sense or from a strictly academic sense, I don't have an explanation for my theistic commitments because they don't ultimately come from my academic discipline or from the world of science. But I would say that even atheists operate day to day on assumptions that they couldn't possibly prove. I don't know that theistic assumptions should be either privileged or disprivileged at the outset on any kind of a priori basis.
All I can say on this question, and it's a hard one, it's not one that I've prepared a paper on, is that my God experience has been real experience. And this is something you can't explain to someone who maybe hasn't had that experience. I must say that my church experience, and I was talking about that in terms of cultural and societal experience a lot in my paper, hasn't been nearly as benign and comfortable as some of the other speakers have encountered. I found myself extraordinarily isolated as a woman, and particularly as a single woman and as an intellectual single woman, and therefore I've been forced to rely on my faith. That's all I've had in a lot of cases, and I can't deny that that's a real force for me. You can call it a paradigm if you want. I don't care what you call it. And I don't see any discrepancy between what I think and what I experience. I would call the ideas I get when I'm writing something that comes through inspiration. You may not like that term. Somehow my mind opens in ways that it doesn't do on my own. I call that a relationship with God. I can't deny that. It's there and it's real and it's what makes my academic discipline work for me. If I didn't have that contact, I would not be able to do the work I do. That's all I can say. But it's not provable, like you said. It's not something I can explain adequately.
Let me just say, too, that I also did not prepare a paper on this topic. It was an excellent question, but I would want to take more time to consider an answer for that. One thing that I will say, I didn't mean to say, and I don't think I said, that I feel closer to God than I ever did before. That's not true. I was trying to say that in my discipline or work with my discipline, I can feel close to God. But I would not say that I feel closer to God than ever before.
Thank you. Next question, Bob Ferdman.
Would any of you three panelists care to speak to the other side of the coin, how your religious views have affected your approach to your academic discipline? Or do you think you've already covered that pretty much in your papers because of the interrelationship between the two? Or do you think it's just, like we've been talking about, the subject of a whole separate paper?
Thank you. Anyone want to?
I do think it's the subject of another paper, and I considered that question when I was preparing my remarks for tonight. What I found even more difficult was really the problem of isolating what would the relationship between my discipline and my beliefs, because as I started trying to assess why I feel the way I do or why I believe the way I do, there were many more variables at play. My discipline was just one of them.
Also, I'd say any discipline is a rather wide sort of thing. And I would certainly say my attraction to Kierkegaard was conditioned by my previous Christian religious belief. That's why probably he affected me in the way he did when other people whose works I've read were interesting, perhaps useful, but didn't strike me in the same way. And I think that's true in any discipline. You'll find certain ideas, certain theories, certain practices that become more appealing or more interesting to you because they tie into something you already believe or something you already feel, and it leads you in that direction.
And I would say, while again I think the topic deserves another paper, I would say the most obvious thing in my life is that at least half of my academic professional preoccupation has been with religious studies in one way or another. And that's a direct outcome of my own effort autobiographically to understand and put together these things. I think it's often true with people who have religious upbringings and get into one or another field or one or another discipline that they find a deep personal internal need to come to terms with the religious questions raised by one's discipline. I think if I had not had a religious bringing up, I probably would not have devoted so much of my professional time and investigation to religious writing or religious sociology of religion.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more question or comment. Are either of you in? Okay, you're just enjoying the chair over there on the side. Well, then I think, at least for me, this has been a fruitful evening. I've enjoyed the thinking about it, and I think it set a good tone for what happens here at the symposium throughout the rest of the week, the blend between the faith and the divine and the human. And as we try to explore that, we bear testimony why we also use our critical tools to analyze what we're about. I need to make one or two final announcements before we close. First is, I assume most or almost everyone has picked up a copy of the final program. This, of course, is important because you will not know what rooms to go to tomorrow unless you have a copy of the final program. So if you haven't, you might want to get one at the registration table on your way out. There are some changes from the previous program that was mailed out, and they're noted in the final program. There's one change that has been added since this went to press. Session 223, which is on Friday, it deals with a student panel dealing with the crisis on the BYU campus. We inadvertently scheduled this during graduation at BYU.
Really make them choose.
But I don't think the students knew it until this weekend. So we had to change it after this went to the press. Regrettably, we try not to make any changes after the final program, and we've been fairly successful at that. So we've moved it to Friday in the afternoon. And that leaves this room empty because that session was going to be broadcast. So we're moving session 225, which was... It's not changing its time, it's just changing its room, so it will be in this room during its hour. I think that's the only change I need to mention in the program. For those who are interested in attending the banquet on Saturday night, in which Mario DePillis will be speaking, he'll be speaking to the subject as an outsider looks at the Mormon intellectual community. Banquet tickets are still available. However, we have to give the hotel a count in a day or day and a half. So do not plan on being able to purchase tickets just before the banquet. You need to do that sometime in advance. And tomorrow night, we have an art auction. This is the first time Sunstone... Perhaps the first time, I'm not sure, Sunstone has tried to raise money through an art auction. This has been advertised to the larger community. We expect other people to join in with us. You're certainly welcome to come. It costs a separate admission. That is to help cover some of the cost of the auction and also to help raise some money for Sunstone. But we've collected quite a nice array of art, and just looking at the art itself is well worth the time, and you
can deduct the cost as a donation, and tickets are available out in the lobby. And I think those are all the announcements that need to be made tonight. Thank you for coming. Yes, here.
I'll return and say, what time, where in the afternoon is this section 223?
Section 223 is moved to Friday the 13th to 2:15 p.m. and it'll be in the granary room. Most of your programs have a little white errata sheet like this. If not, there's some out at the registration table. You can pick that up. I'm sorry, I assumed everyone's reading along with me, and they weren't. That's why I was making this announcement. So session 223 is now moved to 2:15 in the afternoon, and it will be held in the granary room, which is just down the hall. Our first session tomorrow begins at 8 o'clock. It's a devotional. John Armstrong will be speaking, and it's the only thing happening during that half-hour time period. Our concurrent sessions begin at 8:45, and I hope to see you all there. Bonnie Bobet is going to give us our closing prayer. She's an old friend of Sunstone, a longtime friend of Sunstone, and someone who actually has been in our prayers in previous symposiums and is healthy and with us tonight, and we're glad to have her with us. Thank you, Bonnie.
Our dear God, we feel blessed, indeed fed, by the spirit of community that we have shared among us this evening. We're thankful for the openness and humor and goodwill that we share, and we're thankful for the efforts of the Sunstone staff and leaders and all of the participants in this evening's program who have helped to put this program together and catalyze these feelings that we are experiencing together. We're thankful for the message of integration that we've heard this evening, and we pray that we will carry this message and become better enabled to bring together into the various arenas of our lives the sources of empowerment and influence that we feel. And we pray that we will be able to better carry forth that integration into whatever paths our lives take us. We pray for blessings to continue here in the remaining sessions of this symposium. And we pray that this spirit of love and community will pervade. And this we say in Jesus' name. Amen.